It's dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Patients can't always be cured, but they can be healed. And if that sounds confusing, well, you're not alone. I've been trying to wrap my head around that concept since we started planning today's program. Fortunately, we have assembled a group of folks who can explain this new way for doctors to look at patients and for patients to regard their illnesses. A lot of it is spelled out in a book called The Anatomy of Hope, How People Prevail in the Face of Illness, as well as in an upcoming discussion on the topic at Temple Bethel on Saturday. We're going to have it explained to us by our panel this hour. Dr. Derek Raghavan is president of Levine Cancer Institute. I'm actually surprised to see him here today because of flight delays flying in from Australia. Where's your body clock? What day of the week is it for you?
Tuesday.
Thank you for being here. I appreciate it. Try not to fall asleep.
That never happens on your show.
Dr. Russell Greenfield is also with us. He's a medical director of Greenfield Integrative Healthcare. Good to see you again as well.
Thanks a lot, Mike.
And Beth Rosenberg is a licensed clinical social worker at Hospice and Palliative Care Charlotte Region. Good to see you.
Thank you.
And welcome back to the senior rabbi at Temple Bethel, Judy Schindler. Nice to have you with us here, too.
Thank you.
Good morning. As I said, the idea this idea of healing versus curing is a bit confusing, maybe for some, certainly for me. So what's the difference between the two? And I don't know which of you to put that to. Which one of the medical doctors sitting here wants to take that? Go ahead, Dr. Greenfield.
Well, I would put forth that it actually brings up a very interesting issue, first of all, is that we don't have a standard definition for health, which is a problem when you're working in a healthcare system. I think folks in integrative medicine and more practitioners would believe that curing is an act to remove an impediment for healing to take place. It happens more often on the physical realm, let's say, whereas healing actually engages not just the physical, but it also engages the mental, emotional, spiritual components of somebody being well and whole. To be healthy is to be whole, is to be in balance. That balance is dynamic. It's not static. But the idea is, how do we make ourselves as resilient as possible so that we can remain healthy? Sometimes we need to intervene in order to create a cure, which is, again, mainly on the physical realm. But in order to be healthy, you have to focus on all the realms of an individual.
But if I understand this, and correct me if I'm wrong, you can be healed and not cured.
I'll buy into that. Yeah, I think that's partly true. I mean, healing, as Russ said, is not very precisely defined. It's easy, I think, to define cure, as he said. You know, that will be to get rid of a specific illness. Maybe I could give an example.
Okay.
So, you know, when I started in oncology many years ago, testicular cancer, when it spread, killed about 90% of the patients who had it. Now we pretty much cure everybody if we get the formula right. But curing means you get the cancer to go away. As part of the treatment, there'll be a whole bunch of after effects of treatment. There'll be the fear that might have been left over from the fear of cancer. There'll be issues that relate to the kind of psychosocial parts of getting well again. It goes exactly to what Russ was talking about. I've seen cured patients who will never get testis cancer again, who can't get their lives back together.
Hmm.
And people like Russ, like Beth, people like Rabbi Schindler or ministers of faith elsewhere, or it may just be friends and family, will contribute to creating an environment where the patient can get past the fact that their lives were completely disrupted by the illness for a period of time. So healing is getting past that.
Beth.
And also when we think of healing, it's about a personal, internal mindfulness. I find that when people focus on their quality of life, what's going on with them in the immediate day, focus on what makes them happy, hopeful in the face of a chronic illness or a terminal illness, that's when people find more of a mindful healing, and then coping can become more achievable with that illness.
And Rabbi Schindler, I suppose this is where the faith aspect of this comes in as well.
Yes, we're not in the role of curing and physical healing in that way. We're not trained doctors. But instead, as we pray for healing, we pray for three things. We pray for refuat haguf, the healing of the body, refuat nefesh, the healing of the soul, and refuat shlema, a healing of wholeness. So the healing of the body is about finding healing and joy and pleasure in our bodies despite the illness that we are facing. So that could involve, you know, walking, exercising, enjoying nature and food and touch and hugs are all part of the healing of the body. The healing of the soul is about finding meaning and purpose, healing our relationships, finding spirituality, which we achieve through study and prayer and song, poetry, meditation, and music. And then that ultimate refuah shlema, that healing of wholeness, the word shalom, the word shalom, refuah shlema, the healing of wholeness. That is ultimately about transcending the illness, understanding our lives within the larger part of the larger picture of the universe and eternity.
Even people of deep faith, be they Jewish or Christian or Muslim or some other tradition, sometimes when they are faced with their own mortality, suddenly really have difficulty coping. And that's part of the healing process, try to bring that back into alignment in some way.
We're trying to give people the tools to coping. And none of us know that is the ultimate test, right? When you hear that diagnosis, those words, you have cancer. How are you going to face it? And I think none of us can know. We have spent our lives exercising, right? Spiritually, we physically exercise to keep our bodies in shape, right? We intellectually exercise to keep our minds sharp as we age. But we need to also spiritually exercise to work on those parts of our lives to keep us whole in the face of the storms that come our way. But none of us will ultimately know until we hear that diagnosis. My role is to help people find those sources of strength and to bring their life back into balance despite the diagnosis that has really thrown them off course.
And you must, as an oncologist, must face this a lot in your line of work.
Yeah, I think we do. You know, there are two domains of oncology, and Russ and I have talked about this some in the past. You know, there's the easy cure. It's something where you know you have to give chemotherapy or do an operation or use radiation or whatever. Then there's the patient who isn't going to be cured. And that's where this whole concept of healing, integrative medicine, spirituality comes in. I have no really good data to prove what I believe, but I believe that if you can capture the patient's spirit and engage them in believing that they can stay alive, they will live longer than if you don't try. You know, mothers who have young kids somehow manage by processes that we don't really understand, they manage to stay alive. If you give them targets that are appealing to them personally, that will add. So I think the physician who's facing an incurable illness with his patient, who doesn't reach out into a spiritual, integrative, complementary domain to some extent, is probably shortchanging the patient, unless the patient doesn't want it.
This seems pretty forward-thinking for an oncologist, but this is right up your alley, Dr. Greenfield, as an integrative health specialist, because it sounds a little Eastern in its approach as opposed to just simply Western medicine.
Well, this is part of why Derek's president at LCI. you know, but I would put forth that actually, you know, those of us in integrative healthcare believe that it has a role in any patient interaction, because even if it is an easy cure, let's say, people are thrown out of balance over that. And then the idea is, as has been put forth by ancient sages, you always want to take care of something when it's superficial, not when it's gone deep. So if somebody has developed an illness, you take a look and say, okay, why were they susceptible to this? How can we repair it and help build their resilience so they don't get anything like this again? Mm-hmm. And that's where you take a look at things like diet, the spirit, their emotional components, all those different kinds of things.
This is the holistic approach. Is this treating the whole person as opposed to just the symptom of that they come in complaining about?
Well, again, I think this is one of the beauties of this discussion is that, you know, health is being whole. It is being entire. So that's why some people say that health is like a circle, a complete and perfectly balanced circle. But it's also the foundation for holiness. And so it's that balance. And we have to pay attention to all different aspects of a person in order to help them be healthy.
And both of you, both of the doctors here, Dr. Raghavan and Dr. Greenfield, believe in this as a concept and obviously have seen it work in practice. From a person's point of view, way off in the distance like me, who's having trouble grappling with this morning, this is a kind of approach that seems relatively good for something minor. but not for something really serious like cancer. But you're saying the otherwise. This is true in your profession as well, deeply true.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. I think the fact is that you don't spare the treatment. What you do is expand on the treatment. So, there will be times when there's a tension between healing and curing. So, again, going back to my analogy of testicular cancer, sometimes you're really using aggressive treatment and you say to the patient, we're going to expend your quality of life in order to achieve cure. And then you put a layer around that to try to help them to get through the side effects of treatment and so on, if it happens to be tough treatment. There'll be times when you actually have to make a choice. Do you want to survive? If you do, you have to do some tough things, but we will help you get through it, and then we will help you climb back to life as it was mm-hmm. before you got sick, or as close to as it was. And then someone like Rabbi Schindler or a minister of any faith may be part of that. It may be close friends. It may be family. The deal is to get a team, and that's an important concept, is in the past, integrative medicine was over to one side and conventional, if I can call it that, medicine was in its own little silo. I think, at the Levine, we got Russ actually to come over and help us develop an integrative medicine unit. We've got people throughout many different parts of North and South Carolina doing this work. An interesting sideline, my colleagues at ANMED Medical Center in Anderson, South Carolina, which is a little town in South Carolina, actually gave hospital space to the YMCA. So they built the YMCA into the hospital so that they could develop health programs that related to prevention and control and so on. So there is an emerging recognition by mainstream medicine that it hasn't done a good enough job in the past, and you could do better and get better results.
You just mentioned the word control, and a lot of this has to do with patients having control or feeling as though they have control over this illness that they have been stricken with, whatever that illness happens to be. And Beth, you're nodding your head.
Yes. Just in the years of the work I've done, I think one of the hardest things when people do face illnesses, whether they're chronic or terminal, has to do with immediate loss of control. They feel their body has taken control and not their mind to continue their life, to continue what is important to them. So one of the roles that I do is I spend time with the patients and the families to redefine what's important in this time, to change a sense of hope for them in the moment so that they can move through the illness and the process.
I suppose it's one thing to be betrayed by your body. Your mind is thinking my body has betrayed me, so therefore I can't do what I used to do, or I have to fight this illness and it's going to hurt me in the process of doing it. The other part of the control issue, I think, is also the fact that doctors more and more want people to make decisions. And in the process of making those decisions about what course of action to take, they are resuming control. Correct?
Well, absolutely. I mean, once a person receives a challenging diagnosis, within a very short period of time, they're overwhelmed with information, whether mm-hmm. it's through the internet or friends giving them information or books or magazines and their doctors, whatever the case may be. During my brief time at Levine Cancer Institute, we worked with great folks who were coming together to try and make that information overload much more manageable so that people could actually see a clear path down which to go. Because when you've got so many different choices before you, that becomes stressful. And you know what? Stress lessens effectiveness of the immune system, which is the last thing that we want. Speaking to what Beth was talking about just for a moment, a lot of people talk about cure as something that is extrinsic, that comes from outside the person, whereas healing is really inner. It's the inner work of a person. So you don't want to have to choose between one or the other. It's both, and that's why it's termed integrative.
Dr. Russell Greenfield is with Greenfield Health Care, Integrative Health Care. Also with us, Dr. Derek Raghavan, president of Levine Cancer Institute, Rabbi Judy Schindler from Temple Beth-El, and Beth Rosenberg, a licensed clinical social worker with Hospice and Palliative Care Charlotte Region. We have to take a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Nexen Pruitt, lawyers helping companies meet business challenges in court, with regulators, and at the deal table. With offices in Charlotte and 7 other Carolina locations, next challenge, next level, Nexen Pruitt. Charlotte has experienced the good and the bad of growth. We couldn't stop it, growth that is, and we've benefited from it. But as it continues, we have to get smarter about how and where it happens. There's a lot at stake, like maintaining quality of life, even how much you end up paying in taxes. And the city was awarded a grant from Smart Growth America to host a community dialogue on the topic. They want your input, and that conversation begins here tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the stock market, consumer spending, housing prices, and better-than-expected job numbers taking the pulse of the U.S. economy.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to four experts in the field of healing and curing, and that's what we're talking about this morning, healing versus curing. And there is a difference, as we've come to discover. Dr. Derek Raghavan from Levine Cancer Institute, Dr. Russell Greenfield from Greenfield Integrative Healthcare, Beth Rosenberg with Hospice and Palliative Care Charlotte Region, and Rabbi Judy Schindler from Temple Beth El, where on Saturday at 9, they will be conducting a discussion with people called The Anatomy of Hope, How People Prevail in the Face of Illness. What interested Temple Beth El in this topic?
We are in the process of celebrating our 70th anniversary, our 70th birthday as a congregation. And so we have several weekends which celebrate what our congregation has done. And this is our weekend of celebrating healing and social justice. We hear a lot about what the faith community does in the larger community in terms of healing our world and feeding the hungry and helping the homeless and creating affordable housing and working in low-income education, lifting up our students who are most in need. But really, a key function of a house of worship is healing. That aspect. So Saturday morning, as part of our 70th celebration, we have these experts in healing coming to Beth El, and we invite the broader community to join us as we explore what that process is.
That's at 9 o'clock Sunday. It's open to the public in the David Silverman. Open to the public in the David Silverman Social Hall. I'm going to get back to this idea of control, because so in the past, it was the tradition that if you came in with a complaint and the doctor diagnosed it and the doctor would tell you then, here's what we're going to do, and that was the end of that. And most people saw the doctor as God, and that is exactly what I'm going to do because I have no other alternatives. And then something began to change about 10 or 20 years ago with this new generation coming along, and they started asking questions which never got asked before of doctors and wanting more control. And, of course, the Internet, everybody goes to the Mayo Clinic site and self-diagnoses and comes in with all the treatments that they want to have. Which I'm sure can be a nuisance to some doctors because you do know more than we do, even if we do have the Internet at our fingertips. But having that control, being able to ask those questions, being able to decide, okay, I'll go down path A, but I'm not going to do path B, that is in some way healing. Is it not, Beth?
It is. I think although, as we've mentioned, there's so much information out there, but I think when people understand their illness, understand the options, and define what to them is a burden and a benefit, I think at that point it's helpful for them in this healing process and their way to cope and find control.
Mm-hmm. Why is control so important? I guess we take it for granted when we're healthy.
It's a very good question because we, in my experience, just people, you know, once they are aware of their life and their family and who they are in the society, most people want to have control over what happens to them. It makes life easier. They're able to choose paths. So I think it's a good question. It's difficult. I don't think a lot of people have the control they want, mm-hmm. and they don't know how to utilize it. They don't know how to get it.
Dr. Raghavan.
I agree. I think a very interesting kind of example is the people who have the most control over their lives often have the most difficulty being sick. So if you think about a corporate tycoon, a five-star general, the head of a hospital, whatever, when they get sick, they lose almost more control than the guy who just shows up at work and digs a ditch and goes home.
Because he had less control to begin with.
And so I guess my point is that sometimes you have to make adjustments for that and take into consideration how big a sense of loss. The loss of control, I think the driver there is loss as opposed to control. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, how much loss of control needs an adjustment.
And that's part of this process, too, the loss of control, the realization that no matter what the illness is, even if you know down the road you are probably going to be cured, it's a reminder of your mortality. And that you start to mourn for yourself. Is that something that you need to be healed from?
Well, I think that the medical world is overwhelming, right? And it's very technical, and sometimes you lose your sense of being human because a lot of people are coming in and doing procedures, you know, and people feel like they lack control over their bodies. And so we, as other advisors who are there to support them, spiritual advisors and personal advisors, are there to help people make sense and ground themselves as they go through this world. So it's really important, you know, you get overwhelmed by a diagnosis, and then you have to come to terms whether, you know, it's a diagnosis you're going to live with your whole life and have a long life ahead of you, or a potentially terminal diagnosis. You have to decide, okay, how am I going to make it through this fearful sea that I'm passing through? And you need to find those trusted advisors, your team, that is going to help you through. And what we're saying today, it's not just a medical team, right? You need spiritual advisors, and you need health advisors in all aspects of health.
How do you find those people? Because you may not be in a faith community. How do you find those people?
How do you find those people? Well, we are not at a lack of houses of worship here in Charlotte. Mm-hmm. So there's extensive houses of worship, extensive leaders in faith. And then, you know, there's other type of healers who are not religious healers or faith leaders, but other types of spiritual teachers who can guide you. So I think Dr. Greenfield could speak to how to find other sources. And I think there are a lot of people giving you advice when you're sick, right? Telling you about their great aunt Thelma, who had the same cancer 30 years ago. So you need to know also who are your personal advisors, who you're going to listen to and rely upon for guidance. So you need your doctors, you need your faith spiritual healers, and you also need your personal friends who are there for support, because some of your friends might not be the best.
Well, we're speaking a lot about control, and you know, we live in an age of uncertainty, and illness only makes it more so. The idea, I think, in part, is for healthcare practitioners and all healers working with patients is to help folks gain control of what they can control. So that might mean diet. It might mean spirituality. It might mean exercise. You take control of what you can, and what you can't, you work to make peace with. And how do you do that? Well, like you said, you find the people who are going to be your team, because healing takes place in community. And at institutions like Levine Cancer Institute, you have people like nurse navigators, you have social workers, you have an entire team available right there through the medical staff who can help guide you. And you don't want to overwhelm yourself by doing too much, but you want to have access to just the right amount.
I read an article. I want to get your impression of what this article said, that healthcare experts are now recognizing that about 90% of the care needed to manage a chronic disease must come directly from the patient.
I don't actually believe that.
Okay.
I think it's just a team approach, and it's a team approach predicated to some extent on experience, and many patients don't have experience. Mm-hmm. I'll give you a perfect example. You know, when I'm not in practice here in Charlotte, but I've been a practitioner until I came here. And so when I would take on a new patient, I'd pull in the patient, their family, and their friends, and create a network of people. And one of the things that I'd say to them is, don't create a conspiracy of misery. And what I mean by that is, if you go to a hospital, it's interesting, if you're on hospital inpatient service and you watch, people will come in and they'll say, hello, how are we today? They've suddenly isolated the patient. It's no longer a you, it's a we, and we talk like that.
Like a child.
Exactly. Nobody ever comes in and says, oh, man, did you see the game last night? So I've drilled my residents and my fellows and me to come in. We almost never talk about illness first. We'll talk about some aspect that connects the patient to the outside world, if it's an inpatient or even if it's an outpatient. Now, obviously, if someone comes in with a burning issue, you're not going to go off down a side path. But there'll be a lot of people who are sitting in hospital bored and depressed, and the doctor and the nurse can make it worse, yeah, or they can make it better. If the friend comes in and talks to them as if they're a person who happens to have an illness, it's much better than if they talk to this person as a patient whose whole existence is all focused on illness.
I was watching an interview last night with the late comedian Robert Schimmel, and he was talking about getting cancer and having to go in for chemotherapy treatments, and he sat down next to this guy who was just grumpy and unhappy about the whole thing, and just everything was negative. And he told him a joke, and the guy just started to laugh. And he and the nurse came up and said, "What did you say? He has not smiled in 6 months." And the humor kind of healed him, because he came back the next week and he told Robert Schimmel like 100 jokes, and then he came to one of his performances as a stand-up comedian because he got back into life through laughter. That's part of the healing process, I guess.
It's the basis of Norman Cousins' work back in the 70s, Anatomy of an Illness. And laughter works. Laughter heals.
I think you need to live your life beyond the illness. The illness cannot define you. And so how do you do that when you are diagnosed? That's why you need a team outside the medical team who are there to support you and cheer you on. Things like healing services and exercise and yoga, still doing your work of healing the world and giving charity and being outside yourself and realizing there are other people in pain in the world. It's not just your pain. You can retreat and get wrapped up in your world of illness and pain and continue to celebrate the sacred moments of life, whether they're birthdays and anniversaries, other people's birthdays, or the sacred time of your faith.
Put your headphones on. We'll take a couple of calls from folks who've been hanging on for a little while. Marcia, who I think is, it says Presbyterian Hospital Hunter, Huntersville. Welcome. Are you in the hospital or do you work at the hospital?
I work at the Betty Kemp Cancer Support Center.
Okay.
Good morning, Rabbi Judy. Good morning, Beth.
Good morning.
Good morning, Martha.
I'm just really glad that you're having the show today, and just wanted to note communities of support are so critical to someone's adapting and coping with the cancer and metastatic cancer. And we have people, actually one from Temple Beth-El, who initiated a group that we have at Buddy Kemp, which is for metastatic breast cancer survivors. And I think we all say in the cancer community that people need to try to live like they have a chronic illness. That's much easier said than done. But communities of support for everybody who's impacted from the disease is so important for the caregivers, for the children, for maybe the parents. And we do this at the Buddy Kemp Cancer Support Center, and we're glad to be part of the community.
Well, thank you for your call. I appreciate it. Anybody want to comment on that? Okay, we'll move on. But thank you, Marcia, for your call. I appreciate it. Linda, welcome to the program.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
I'm calling because I'm the parent of an adult child who has Hodgkin's lymphoma, and she's been battling for 4 years. And she's actually in New York City being treated at Columbia Presbyterian. But I wanted to say what an uplifting message this is today, because the concepts of team, the concepts of faith, the concepts of attitude really have sustained our daughter as she has continued to deal with, fight, and we pray ultimately reach the level that she's no longer battling Hodgkin's. She's in that small percentage that has a difficulty getting to remission. But what she does is she's gotten married through all of this. She exercises. She lives her life. And she is a person of faith, and that has sustained us. And I have often said that our daughter's name has been spoken, Rabbi Judy, in your temple and in every church in Charlotte, and the prayer gets us through. And so, again, the words that your panel have provided today uplift not only the patients but the caregivers, because it's difficult to watch your child deal with this from a distance, and yet she inspires us. So thank you for the conversation.
You're welcome. Thank you. Go ahead.
I think that notion of caregivers needing support is critical, because it is exhausting to care for your loved one and worry about your loved one and be there, mm-hmm. and you need support as well. And you can't be there to support others unless you're feeling that sense of wholeness. Mm-hmm. And there's this concept in the Book of Numbers, which is different, but when you have an interaction with somebody who's died, there's a ritual for healing, and the healer needs healing. So at Temple Beth-El, when we offer our prayer for healing each and every Shabbat, the first verse of the prayer is said for everyone in the sanctuary. We all are broken by the pain of our world, and we need healing, and we need wholeness in order to offer wholeness to others.
Dr. Raghavan.
Just coming back to Linda from a moment ago, you know, one of the things that you might be interested in, Linda, we have a patient and carers support group at the Levine focused on Hodgkin's lymph and other lymphomas. And we're actually doing something now that's a little bit different, which is we're developing an e-support group. So we're actually going to do video conferencing throughout our system. So you could sit in Charleston or Anderson or Concord or somewhere and participate in a patient support or a family support group. And we don't separate them. We've got them in together. And that has a mix of people who've been cured, people who are still fighting, family, navigators, carers. And it goes to the whole kind of holistic piece. And the fact that your daughter is being treated in New York City doesn't preclude you from joining such a group. And so it goes back to your earlier question, Mike. How do you get information? You know, you can get it from navigators. You can get it from support groups. I think the Buddy Camp has similar sorts of facilities on a slightly smaller scale. Beth. So we're there.
Beth.
And I think support groups are so important for patients as well as the caregivers, because it's an environment where everyone shares their stories, their life experience, and people feed off of one another's strengths in order to find the path that best helps them. If someone has never walked a path of illness or being a caregiver, then they are lost sometimes. And to hear how people have overcome adversity and then, in essence, they share their stories, people can find wholeness and the place of going back to the control where they felt like they had no control. They can regain some of that.
Thank you for your call, Linda. David on Facebook writes, Dr. Arthur Kleinman at Harvard has written extensively for decades on the difference between illness and disease. One can be healed of the illness or cured. Well, not being cured of the disease. Are you familiar with that concept and his work?
Kleinman is actually very, very well regarded in this realm. And again, the idea here being that if you can be at peace emotionally, spiritually, and take control of what you can from a physical perspective, even if you still have an illness, a chronic malady, whatever the case may be, you can still, as Rabbi Judy said, engage in life to its fullest and, again, making peace with what you've experienced, maybe even garnering some wisdom that can be shared with others and help them.
We have an email from an unidentified person. I'm interested to hear your guest's thoughts on the severe fear that many people face as to whether they can afford the help they need and how this can affect their state of mind or body or spirit. I see a potential for a real sense of hopelessness in this situation. Doctor.
Well, I think one of the, you know, I'm an immigrant to America and I love being here, but I really feel sad that our government hasn't acknowledged the fact that it can't pay for the healthcare services that we want. And so that puts the onus on patients, and there's no question it adds a huge dimension to the suffering that can go with any illness. You know, when you're worrying about how to pay the bills, it's a really big deal. You know, we have legislation in the state at the moment that makes it much harder for people to get federal assistance, and that's a bad thing. I think that the people at the bottom of the socioeconomic hierarchy, those who are the poorest, the old, the elderly, the isolated suffer the most. And I think if we want to be what we present ourselves as Americans who are at the top of the universe, we need to do a better job of providing care to everyone and making it less burdensome financially.
I want to talk to Rabbi Schindler about that for a second, because we profess to be a nation of believers. Why then do we have to take this hard line on healthcare? And I only have 20 seconds.
Oh, gosh.
If you'd like to think about that, we can take it on the other side of the break.
Okay,
we'll do that on the other side of the break. Rabbi Judy Schindler from Temple Beth-El, Dr. Russell Greenfield from Greenfield Integrative Healthcare, Dr. Derek Raghavan from the Levine Cancer Institute, and Beth Rosenberg with Hospice and Palliative Care Charlotte Region. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFA. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the May 20th Society's annual MECDEC Speakers Series with Isabel Wilkerson, author of The Warmth of Other Suns, a story about the Great Migration, May 20th at McGlowan Theater. Tickets at carolinatix.org. And Wells Fargo, working with the Friendship Community Development Corporation to help provide local services throughout Charlotte. Details on Wells Fargo's work in the community can be found at wellsfargo.com/commitment. The stock market, consumer consumer spending, housing prices, and better-than-expected job numbers. Taking the pulse of the U.S. economy, the topic of the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock in about 20 minutes. By the way, our guest today will be part of a panel discussion on the Anatomy of Hope on Saturday at 9 a.m. at Temple Beth El. You can find information on that on our website at wfae.org/charlottetalks. You can always make a comment or ask a question there, or do it at 704-926-WFAE or 800-603-WFAE.
Have you ever heard an idea that changed the way you look at the world?
Everything we think,
we've
we
had
feel,
to believe in impossible things.
Infinite possibility and that sense of potential. And I realize
and we've
that
had to refuse
persist.
To fear failure.
You've got to persist through failure.
You can contemplate the meaning of infinity.
I'm Guy Raz. Join me each week for Ideas Worth Spreading on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Now on Sundays at 4 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about healing versus curing, and we'll get into some other aspects of this in terms of palliative care in a moment. But I asked a question of Rabbi Schindler about commenting on Dr. Raghavan's comment that he thinks it's unfortunate that we have a healthcare system in this country guided by government rules and regulations that prevent a lot of people who need the care, who can't afford the care, they can't get the care. And why don't we take a hard line in a country that professes to be a country that has strongly held religious foundational beliefs? Why do we take a hard line on healthcare?
Well, I think that we are a country of many beliefs. We're a diversity of beliefs. So you can't say we're just one type of belief. But all of our faith systems, I believe, support the notion of equity and equality. And so we need to advocate for those policies that will move forward the teachings of our faith systems. I think politicians are torn. They have many conflicted agendas coming their way, and they're torn by lobbyists and every direction, and it's hard for them to move forward. So I think it's up to us as believers in equity and equality to speak out loudly to our politicians, to pick up the phone, to write emails, to say this is a value that is of the utmost importance, that everyone gets the health care that they need.
Beth Rosenberg is here. She's a licensed clinical and social worker with Hospice and Palliative Care Charlotte Region, and she is not here simply because hospice helps people die. They help people live. And palliative care is used not just for people who are dying and who are in intense pain. It's to help heal them, not just cure them, and go on to life, correct?
Yes. My work is specifically on the hospice of our organization. So we have palliative and hospice care. Mm-hmm. My experience is mainly working with patients who are in the terminal phase as well as their families. And when I meet families, they are at their most vulnerable. And I sit with them and I listen to their stories and I listen to their experiences and as they, so a lot of times people say to me, you know, I can't talk to you, I can't talk about my death, and I explain to them, I'm here to talk about how we're going to help you live. Certainly living with a terminal illness, but helping you get through the next few days, the next few weeks, the next few months. What are your goals? What are the important things to help the family unit as a whole get through this time? We were talking earlier about team supports. One of the things that hospice has is an incredible focus of team support for person-centered care. It is about learning who that person is in the environment they're living in, focusing on what they need to enhance their life and make their days as best as they can. So that is both with social workers and nurses, and we have chaplains and volunteers, but also medical management of that palliation of the symptoms that can cause discomfort or pain, whatever that is.
Define palliative care.
Palliative care is taking away a painful stimulus that's happening to the body, whether it be acute pain or respiratory distress or nausea or vomiting. Palliative practitioners, although we're not necessarily cardiologists or oncologists, that the doctors that and the nurses focus on the body as a whole, understanding all the disease processes and focuses on medication and other management of how to make that body have the best quality, the best healing as far as feeling well. So it doesn't necessarily focus on the curative piece and making the body cure of cancer or heart disease. But when you're in distress, how do we make the body comfortable?
And you also work with people who do not have terminal illnesses, don't you?
Palliative practitioners do. Hospice is
not.
Basically the focus is when a doctor feels someone has 6 months or less. But we have many people under care that have been under care for a year or two. So it depends on, you know, people's. I find that in the face of terminal illnesses, we can't define when that last day is going to be because people exceed their life expectancy with finding hope.
Mm. One of the things that brings to mind that you were speaking about, Beth, for me is when I first started down this path of integrative medicine and my peers and I were studying with Dr. Weil in Arizona, one of the comments that was brought up was that the notion that healing and dying are not incompatible with one another, which blew my mind. As an emergency physician, you know, death was the enemy and you were doing everything you could in order to stop that. But we talked about and we thought about it a lot, and I think I get it now, and that the idea of healing around the concept of death is to be at peace, to feel that you have created a complete and whole and fulfilling life, to release the things that were difficult, to make peace with things or people that you need to at that time, and to be, again, in balance in that space, even though the physical body may not be persisting for years to come.
Go ahead, Dr. O'Donnell.
I was just going to say that I agree with all of that. You know, one of the things that I think has really improved in the last 30 years has been the concept of transitioning of care. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I first started, physicians often felt that if a patient was dying, it represented the doctor's failure. And so sometimes they would pull back from the patient, kind of walling themselves off and doing a bad thing. Today, we recognize reality. There is a much greater emphasis on a smooth transition. So in where I work, we actually have employed people like Beth as part of our team to do palliative medicine. There will be transitioning of care long before we've given up the battle. But what it allows is the development of new relationships with different emphases. So a patient that I'm looking after will have me as his or her physician, but will pick up another physician or a social worker or a nurse as part of their network. So there isn't this sudden, oh, I'm now dying, nobody cares kind of sense, which actually used to happen somewhat. This ability to recognize that death is inevitable, that some people will die sooner, and that we'll try to delay it but maintain quality of life and kind of, in a way, without meaning to sound paternalistic, wrap the patient up in enough layers of support so that it doesn't have them saying, yippee, I'm going to die, but it doesn't have the cognitive overlay of abandonment, of fear, and so on. You can actually make death a much better thing. And part of it, and it's implicit in everything Rabbi Judy has said and Beth and Russ and myself, it's all about planning. It's all about understanding teamwork and setting up an algorithm that's pre-planned so that you don't have sudden panic stations going, oh, my God, we didn't expect this. Mm-hmm. That will make patients more scared. The ability to have transitioning of care and as logical a progression as you can if you're not going to cure and heal the patient. That's a good thing.
The discussion that you're having on Saturday morning at Temple Bethel at 9 is called The Anatomy of Hope, and it's based on the title of a book by Jerome Groopman, also a medical doctor. Why is that an apt title for this discussion?
I think because of that journey. You know, the journey starts with the diagnosis or the body feeling off balance. You know something's wrong through the diagnosis to the process of healing. And sometimes that journey involves death, that you will die as a result of that journey. But hope is critical along the way, and hope is essential to making it through that journey. I mean, Elliot Dorff wrote, the Talmud asserts that we should not depend on miracles. We should instead do what we can to heal each other in the world and simultaneously pray to God to help. And there's all these different levels of hope. You hope you'll be able to cope with suffering. You hope for remission, if not a cure. You hope for enough time to achieve a goal. You hope for future welfare of your family. You hope to reconcile with family members and others before death. You hope to keep your dignity. You hope for life after life. And so there's a long journey. All of us will inevitably face death, and we're all on that journey and how to make that journey a beautiful, holy, whole journey.
You know, there was a great physician named Bernie Siegel who once spoke about hope and saying that physicians often don't provide hope. We often provide false despair. We say things aren't going to get better or this is what's going to happen. But, you know, doctors and healthcare providers, we are not soothsayers. Mm-hmm. And what Dr. Siegel says is that hope is the desire for a positive outcome in the face of adversity. And nobody should have their hope taken away from them because everybody has seen folks respond to treatment where the odds were against them and things can happen.
And Dr. Groopman, who wrote the book, The Anatomy of Hope, says hope can only arrive when you recognize that there are real options and that you have genuine choices. Hope can flourish only when you believe that what you can do can make a difference and that your actions can bring a future different from the present. In the face of a terminal illness, explain that comment.
Well, I still think that folks can participate in their care and do things that might help the treatment be more successful. You know, what physicians do in large part is, again, treat illness in the best way that they can, but also remove impediments for that person's own innate healing capacity to take hold and work to its best potential. And then we see what happens. So it's not just to give up. It's like Dr. Raghavan said, we're not just saying, well, you know, it's all over. There's nothing you can do. There's always something that could be done.
Yeah, I agree. I had a patient once who had carcinomatous meningitis, cancer spread around the brain, and her prognosis was about 3 months. She had a young son and had reasons to stay alive as long as possible, and we accepted that was one of her targets. Another target was to try to get some control of the disease. And I layered in a third thing, which is, tell me one thing you always wanted to do that we could work on while you're at this phase. And she said, I always wanted to learn to paint. I have her first oil painting hanging at home. So you can do an incredible amount with a limited amount of time. And sometimes you're ahead of the game. Someone who gets killed in a car accident doesn't have that
right.
period to use.
Right. Let me take a call from someone who identifies themselves as Dr. Dr. Galley. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks, Mike. I'm the Buddhist chaplain for the Presbyterian Nevada Health System. And I really appreciate the program here today. I had a couple comments. One is that you had said something about what do you do with people who have no faith community, mm-hmm. but also what do you do with people who have no faith or no faith beliefs, no holding of a God. That the things that these people are talking about are very valuable for anybody, not just for people who have a belief, okay? And the other thing I wanted to say was that death is actually part of the life process. That's the, you know, there's a birth, a life, and a death. And so that one of the first things that one does should be to accept the fact that we all die. And then we can rejoice and, you know, involve ourselves in the living and the healing process that, you know, is being offered by these various support groups and individuals. Amen. And that's it.
Okay. Anybody want to comment on that?
Sometimes people want to address death early on, right, and overcome that fear of dying so that they can live fully. They mm-hmm. get a diagnosis, especially with the return of a cancer. That's the most fearful moment. Oh, my gosh, I could die of this illness. And sometimes coming to terms with their death helps them to live fully and fight more fully their disease. One thing I do with patients when they are comfortable coming to terms with their death is we write letters. So we had a patient just 3 weeks ago who passed away, and I came in with a computer. We wrote letters to his parents, to his wife, to his children, to his sibling, to his mother-in-law, and that they could open after the funeral. And he even wrote, you know, some words I could share at the funeral, words of gratitude for all that he had.
Yes.
And there's something that I try to implement or encourage patients and to do, and anyone can start this today, and it's called Ethical Wills. It's life review. It is someone sitting down and either writing their life story, what's important, so that they can pass those stories and their lessons to other generations. Mm. People's, one of their fears is to die with no meaning in their life. And it's a way that people can relive their life and find that meaning that they need to find the closure. It's an incredible healing process for people to go through.
There are books on ethical wills that you can purchase, and we recommend that people start their ethical will at the High Holidays, our Jewish most mm-hmm. holy moment, that they reflect on their life and that they edit their ethical will, their letters to their family members, each and every year. So every time I take a major overseas trip, I write a letter to my family, and, you know, it's in the drawer by my bed just in case.
Just in case. Dr. Raghavan.
I was just going to say, to kind of bring it all together, one of the things that I believe Russ does very well is to listen. So you can enable a patient to have control by listening to what their issues are. And if you do a cookie-cutter approach, I think you'll fail. If you listen to what their drivers are, what makes them fearful, what's likely to make them feel better, listening is a very important part of allocating control back to the patient.
Dr. Galley, thank you for your call. Martha emails, my husband had a serious diagnosis with a very rare illness. He had to undergo an experimental stem cell transplant in Boston, where he was a patient number 5 in a clinical trial. He suffered severe complications post-transplant, but had the good fortune to be cared for at CMC Maine in progressive care. While there, we had the support of Beth Rosenberg and a superlative team of healthcare providers who worked in integration to sort out perhaps the most complex case many of them had ever seen. Our entire family was able to manage through the illness because of the way they were cared for by our team. I understand the concept of healthy but not cured. My husband's illness is considered incurable, but because of the experimental nature of his treatment, he may be cured. But because of his team, he is certainly healthy. He is back to work full-time and now more than 1,000 days post-transplant. A major component was the hope that everyone dedicated themselves to. Beth, you were involved in that. Your team was involved in that.
Yes. Thank you so much for those kind words. And that is the goal. It's the goal is to be present, to listen to the person fully, to understand what they want, to listen to the caregivers. One of the things that I think are most important as you are trying to help your friends or family or loved ones is to just sit and have them explain to you what they need in this moment and not judge that, whatever that need is and on that day. I encourage people to look at the next 2 or 3 days and then move on from there. Have goals, but definitely let's get to the next few days. In order to get to the next few days.
We never got to talk about the importance of attitude in all of this. And you say, Beth, that many people discover healing by understanding how they overcame adversity in the past. That's something you help them to understand.
Definitely.
And that plays a major role in helping people through
If you have had losses in the past and you can remember and understand how you overcame that adversity, that loss, we all have losses, then you can find healing, I believe.
Beth Rosenberg, a licensed clinical and social worker at Hospice and Palliative Care Charlotte Region. Rabbi Judy Schindler from Temple Bethel. Dr. Eric Derrick.